Buenos días a todos, bienvenidos a esta nueva sesión del Seminario de Historia Política y Cultural. Hoy tenemos el placer de tener la profesora Kate Ferris. Kate Ferris es profesora en la School of History de la Universidad de St. Andrews en Escocia. Es una experta en historia europea moderna, ha estudiado extensamente y sigue estudiando Italia y España en el periodo de los últimos finales, digamos, del siglo XIX hasta mediados del siglo XX, y su enfoque de análisis es cuestiones de subjetividad, la experiencia vivida de la dictadura, procesos de producción y recepción cultural. Ha publicado extensamente sobre estos temas. Su último artículo, que me parece que ha salido en septiembre de este año, Food and Its Power, Recent Historiographical Developments in the History of Food and the Fascism, ha publicado varios volúmenes sobre fascismo en Everyday y Vida de Todos los Días durante el fascismo en Italia, una de sus, que me imagino que será la monografía que ha salido de su PhD, Everyday Life in Fascist Venice, en 2012, y hoy nos hablará de prácticas de la vida cotidiana en las dictaduras de la Europa del Sur a través de miniaturas. Entonces, Kate, thank you for coming. It's a pleasure for us to have you here. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Georgia, for inviting me. Thank you, Carlos, for all of your organization of this. And it's lovely to meet you all. So I'd like to start by explaining my use of the term miniatures in the title of my talk. So the term miniatures was coined by the pioneer of Alltagsgeschichte, or everyday life history, Alf Lüdke, who used it to mark out his methodological approach to his sources. And in his works, and in his, particularly in his sort of defense of the approach of Alltagsgeschichte, which is published in English as The History of Everyday Life, he insisted that everyday life historians should uncover, quote, the contexts and miniatures of people's lived experiences. And so miniatures in this case denotes small stories, the kind of small stories that are very locally or subjectively bound, which contain within them kernels of meaning that historians can unpick and explore and place alongside other such stories in order to build what Lüdke called a mosaic or collage of miniatures. And this methodological approach does not indicate any kind of attempt to constitute a sort of comprehensive total history from the smallest components, from these small stories or miniatures, but rather by honing in on the miniature, Lüdke suggested that, and this is a quote from him, the density of life situations and contexts of action can be made vivid and palpable. And by assembling these miniatures into collages or mosaics, the everyday life historian is able to render, and this is another quote from him, individual layers or nodes within societal patchwork structures, three-dimensional and plastic. So in other words, these collages of miniatures can reveal how macro processes play out on micro scales, and vice versa, how micro happenings together weave the macro scale. And they sort of bring into relief these societal patchwork structures and some of the unevenness and the messiness and the multiplicities and the inconsistencies of the structures and relations of power in their actual functioning. And I'm going to recount several miniatures today. So the research findings that I'm going to talk to you about today come from the ERC-funded research project, which explores everyday life and the lived experience of dictatorship in 20th century Southern Europe, for which I was the PI, and which ran from 2018 to 2024. And, well, as Georgia mentioned, since my doctoral studies, my research has examined questions of everyday life in 20th century dictatorship, with my focus falling especially, or initially at least, on fascist Italy, and particularly on the city of Venice. And then that sort of the natural progression of my research interests in Italy brought me to extend the comparative frame of my research to other forms of fascistic or dictatorial rule in other Southern European countries, and I've been able to do that through this project, which focuses on fascist Italy, Francoist Spain, Salazar's Portugal, and Greece under Metaxas and the Colonels. And actually, in the project's latest phase, we were able to expand the comparative frame even further, because I was able to work with scholars with expertise in colonial and post-colonial authoritarian regimes in Latin America and Southern Africa. And actually, we just published an article on Wednesday, which is in the Historical Journal, which is intended to sort of decenter Europe in everyday life history approaches and to connect the histories of everyday life produced by and on Southern Europe with those produced by and on Southern Africa and Latin America. So in this talk, what I want to do is to give a very brief overview of the conceptual framing of the ERC project, and then following that, I'd like to share some of the comparative findings that we explore in one of our project publications, which is a co-authored book which thematically examines everyday life in the four dictatorships that I just mentioned. I'm currently writing up this book along with Hugh Halstead, who is listed on the slide, was one of the postdoctoral research fellows on the project, and he's now a lecturer in public history at Edinburgh. But all of the research findings I'm going to talk about today are the joint research findings produced by all of the research team members listed on the board. So I just want to acknowledge that that this talk today is very much founded on other people's research as well as my own. So in general terms, the research project is interested in examining questions of everyday agency, subjectivity and experience, practice, space, and the interrelation of these. And so fundamentally, we ask how these dictatorships were experienced and how they were effectively shaped and constituted from below as well as from above. And so in that sense, we're working from the premise that while dictatorships are, of course, put into effect from on high, and from a central seat of power by the dictators and by their supporters and acolytes and the apparatus that they construct, they are also in effect enacted from below in the local spaces and sort of everyday cultures that are inhabited and performed day by day by the people who live through these regimes. So that means partly recognising that local representatives of the state, so party officials, civil servants, police officers and so on, but also those who have semi-official positions of trust, whether it be doctors, midwives, university professors, teachers, journalists and so on, they are all charged with putting into practice the intended aims and the policies of the dictators. And sometimes, given the peculiarities of particular local contexts and individuals' own interpretation of these aims, there can be the potential for some distortion or modification in that process of enacting dictatorial authority. Crucially, though, we also recognise that dictatorships are experienced subjectively by the individuals who live within their borders. People who, through their own agency, through their actions, their practices and their attitudes, have some capacity, even though, of course, it's heavily limited and circumscribed in many ways, have some capacity to contribute to the making and therefore potentially also to the unmaking of dictatorship. So we might think of the basic unit of experience of dictatorship as being locally and subjectively bound, and as such, in our view at least, the everyday becomes a very sort of vitally important arena in which political relations between individuals and the dictatorial regimes are effectively constituted. So in pursuing this kind of understanding of the workings of dictatorial regimes, we find many influences and inspiration in various historiographical and methodological exemplars, and there are just some examples on the slide behind me. So very naturally, we are inspired by the writings and conceptual tools proposed by the Alltagsgeschichte historians of National Socialist Germany, most notably Arthur Lüdke, of course, but also by historians working in other contexts, like Sheila Fitzpatrick and her very foundational work on Stalinist Russia. We take my sort of methodological clues also from microhistory approaches, particularly in relation to the idea of the exceptional typical, but also from the history workshop movement and the history from below traditions that arose in the UK in following the Second World War. But also in other ideas and concepts and methods proposed by scholars like Michel de Certeau, Luisa Passerini, Alessandro Portelli, and by scholars working beyond European frames of reference and often beyond the discipline of history. And so there I would point to James C. Scott and his work on forms of hidden transcripts and everyday resistance, which he explored in an East Asian, Southeast Asian context, and Njabula Ndebele's work on ordinariness and it's sort of corollary of spectacularity, which she developed in relation to apartheid South Africa. So how we conceive of, how we understand, and how we define what we mean by the everyday is clearly a very important question to address, but I don't think I have a lot of time here to kind of at least enter into a very long discussion of this. So for now, what I would just say is that for me, it's actually sort of the inherent instability of the concept. It's the inherent ambiguity of what we might understand to comprise everyday life that is a key source of its attraction. So we don't, in this project, understand the everyday as a very sort of fixable and a very easily definable thing. And it's not, or certainly it's not only, to be understood as a temporal or a chronological category, or as a solely spatial entity. So it's not, everyday life isn't just something that happens in particular spaces and places. And it's not, or it's not only a binary category. So it's not only something that is understood in opposition to the not everyday, to the extraordinary or the spectacular. What for us, examining the everyday life, the other thing is not certainly or not only is history that focuses on a certain group or class of people. So it's not just kind of a sort of working class history, because we have to also recognise that, of course, people who are privileged, people who are in positions of power, and even dictators, of course, have their own everyday lives. Not that that's something that we particularly have had any interest in this project, but still, they would have them. So having said all of that, all of those components still come together in some way to inform how we think about the everyday. So temporality, space, the relationship between the ordinary and the extraordinary, intersectionality, positionality in relation to authority and the exercising of power, all of these are important facets for us to analyse. And in that sense, what we're doing then is deploying the everyday as a sort of heuristic frame, so a tool, really, a sort of analytical tool, as a way of sort of seeing the past as a sort of set of questions or an arena in which you can ask certain questions about and make sense of the functioning of human agency, of subjectivity, of practice, of space, spatial relations, and so on, and the sort of interplay of all of these in dictatorship. And it's a sort of set of questions through which we hope to better understand some of the more complex, messy, and also transitory and sort of unfixable dimensions of past lives lived under and through dictatorship, and hopefully to better understand how the exercising of power and agency actually played out day to day and on the ground in these dictatorial contexts. So just coming to the second part of the slide, the sources. So to uncover and address these issues and questions, in the project, we use a wide range of source materials. We use a lot of ego documents, of course, letters, diaries, and memoirs. In the Greek case, we use oral history testimony, so I'll be citing some of those interviews that were conducted by my colleague Hugh Halstead. We also use, of course, various types of officially produced or semi-officially produced sources, like government documents, police reports, newspaper articles, photographs, newsreels, and so on. And with those, of course, we try to read them along the grain, but also, very importantly, we read them against the grain for what they can reveal about practices, experiences, and agency from a bottom-up perspective. So I'll use all of these, or almost all of these types of sources, in the miniatures that I talk about today. Very final note, then, and so this is in this sort of introductory part of the talk, is to just address the comparative dimension of the project. So a key intention of the project is to demonstrate the value of bringing Southern Europe into the comparative frame of existing scholarship on historical dictatorship, which, with many exceptions, very notable exceptions, has tended to pivot on other axes. So we have many more kind of comparative works that compare, for example, Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, or Nazi Germany with Italy, or Germany with Eastern Europe. And so what we are trying to do, as others have been doing, is to Of course, sort of acknowledge those important axes, but to suggest that a Southern European frame is also an interesting axis of comparison to explore. And of course, we in the project ignore the very important transnational and translocal dimensions of these dictatorships. But our approach is predominantly comparative, and importantly, what we're not doing here in our comparison is trying to somehow fix and compare sort of static snapshots of what everyday life was like in ex-dictatorship or in comparison to Y dictatorship. I think that would be neither feasible nor desirable. So rather what we're trying to do is that we're using what we might call our units of comparison as being different modes of behaviour, different ways of relating to dictatorship. Our units of comparison are informed by the conceptual tools that we use, those of Lüdke's, Lüdke's notion of Eigensinn or self-willed behaviour, self-assertive behaviour, of evasion and finding room for manoeuvre. Our unit of comparison is also the kind of tactics that de Certeau described as operating very frequently in everyday life settings, and also Luisa Passerini's notion of mediators, among many others. So those are the kinds of things that we're comparing, and I think that helps us to work our way, I hope it helps us to work our way through and sort of around some of the sort of clear challenges that we know exist in terms of doing comparative history, especially when you're dealing with diachronic and ever sort of changing case studies, which can't just be fixed and compared because precisely they're continually changing and uneven, and because one's experience of these regimes is diverse and is contingent depending on many factors like positionality, so one's class, one's gender, one's race, ethnicity, one's age, where one is in the dictatorship, when in the dictatorship we're talking about, all of these things shape and make it very difficult to kind of fix a picture that can somehow be compared. So what we're trying to do then is instead to compare and to better understand within their own contexts these sort of multivalent practices, these modes of behaviour, these ways of relating, both between individuals and also between individuals and the state. And I think that is more reflective of the sort of relatively small and everyday scale that effectively was a unit of experience through which individuals actually encountered the regimes. These are the settings, these are the kinds of encounters that most people had with dictatorship in their day-to-day lives. So moving then now to the main part of the talk, I just want to share some of the findings of this comparative book that we're writing on everyday life in the Southern European case study dictatorships that we're looking at in Italy, Portugal, Spain and Greece. And so the book is structured thematically. We constantly kind of compare and invoke examples from the different cases side by side, actually along themes that when I first wrote the ERC grant proposal, I could never have anticipated. But these are themes that which sort of emerged and seem to us to be the most pertinent and the most novel based on our reading of the source material, the archival and the other research material that we amassed. So I'm going to speak mostly to one of the themes or one of the chapters of the book, which kind of considers forms of intimacy and forms of social bonds and relationships under the dictatorship. And I will mention at the end a little bit some of the material relating to another of the chapters and themes that we look at, which is effectively sort of the flip side or the inverse of social bonds and intimacy, and that's the experience of isolation and solitude, or what we've called in that chapter being alone in the dictatorship. So just starting with our research, and actually, sorry, I should show you that one. Okay, so let me start with the chapter and the themes that we discuss on intimacy, social bonds and relationships. And so in our chapter, that means we look at family relationships, particularly relationships between spouses and between parents and children, also wider sort of kinship and household relationships, but also sort of broader relationships. So, for example, the relationships and bonds that exist between teachers and pupils and parents, and also between friends and within neighbourhoods. And so historiographically and methodologically, there were three principal points of departure for us in this chapter. So the first point of departure, first starting point for us was the emphasis that has been very widely written about by historians, which is that all of the regimes that we examine place such enormous importance on the family as being, the Italian Fascist Party Secretary Augusto Turati put it, the basic cell of the state, the nation and the people. So the family understood as a kind of fundamental building block of these regimes' projects, And the family imagined both in idealized terms as a sort of natural repository of regime virtues and values, but also viewed in more practical, pragmatic terms as a kind of entity, a sort of set of relations into which it was entirely legitimate for the dictatorship to intervene. So that's one starting point. Second starting point was that we wanted to examine how family and friend relationships and networks and bonds could be invoked not only by the regimes, but also by people living in the dictatorships as they kind of navigated regime policies and strictures. And we know, for example, from the historian of fascist Italy, Luisa Passerini, that family members very often made good mediators, as she puts it, as kind of a bridge between individuals and the regime, and especially women made good mediators. So we wanted to further explore that across the four case studies that we look at, and we wanted to see how, in practice, these relationships, these bonds, were instrumentalized both by the regime and also by individuals, and also what resulted from that kind of mobilizing or instrumentalizing practice. So how did effective relationships, or how were effective relationships invoked, both perhaps to evade or to lessen the imposition of the dictatorship in some way, or to curry favor with the regime, so to bring it closer, or to perhaps push it away, or was it actually so, or perhaps even something in between, something much more ambivalent. And so I suppose as a little aside, I would mention that we do, of course, also in the chapter recognise that not everybody could draw on these kinds of family relationships and these kinds of family bonds, and that there is, of course, a huge variety in the kind of relations and bonds that people experience, and not all, of course, were harmonious or supportive, and many of them, in fact, would be conflictual or could break down or could entail violence, and that's something that we do address in the chapter, and I guess we'll come in a little bit in this talk, perhaps. And then the third sort of starting point was that we wanted to take up the conceptual argument that's made by Alf Lüdke and Sheila Fitzpatrick in her 2012 2012 chapter of an edited book that's called Beyond Totalitarianism. And in that chapter, they draw on and probe Hannah Arendt's suggestion that the atomization of society was a kind of key mainstay of a totalitarian regime. So that's a really fundamental kind of premise from which historians and political scientists have been working for the last 70 years or so. So in Fitzpatrick and Lüdke's chapter, they discuss... So they want to kind of probe that Hannah Arendt's idea of the atomization of society by looking at what happens to everyday social bonds in Nazi Germany and in the Soviet Union. And they discuss three predominant ways in which these bonds and relationships were impacted by dictatorial rule. So first, they noted the creation of new social bonds, many of which were actively promoted or desired by the regime, but also could conversely arise from the regime's politics of exclusion. So that's the first one, new kinds of social bonds from processes of inclusion and exclusion. The second way that they saw social bonds as being impacted was through the... sort of social bonds and relationships that predated the rise to power of the dictatorship could actually be strengthened or could be re-energized and appropriated by the regime. And then thirdly, they saw and showed how those same pre-existing bonds could be damaged or could be weakened or indeed could be very literally in some cases destroyed by the regime. So that was a kind of conceptual framework that we wanted to work with. So now I finally come to what we actually found. So, very often, of course, state intervention in family relationships came at the instigation of the dictatorial regime. And we might say that at base it was through individual Italian, Spanish, Portuguese and Greek bodies and through their familial and other relational roles that the dictatorial regimes evaluated and determined men and women's contribution to their national project, and imperial in the case of Italy, Spain and Portugal. And it was through their bodies and their relational roles that their status in many ways within the dictatorship was determined. And so in their most intimate practices, including sexuality and procreation, individual male and female bodies were, in idealized terms, expected to be disciplined and directed towards state goals of a numerous and increasing population that would be worthy of and capable of securing international prestige and imperial expansion. But also female and male relational roles were sort of quite explicitly and directly connected to their status. So, for example, in Italy, to be the mother of a fallen soldier was a huge marker of esteem, which brought those women very important symbolic roles within fascist spectacles, particularly those that promoted sacrifice, duty, and war. So, for example, in during the time of the League of Nations sanctions placed on Italy and the Ethiopian War, very often women who had lost a son in that war, or in or even in the sort of the fascist, in the violence that accompanied the fascist rise to power, would be placed in really important symbolic roles during the course of the Ethiopian War, because their status as the mother of a fallen soldier marked them as a kind of, you know, as having this kind of esteem. Similarly, though, in Metaxas's Greece, young girls were told that they should grow up to be somehow both Spartanesque militant mothers and also queen of housewives. So to live up to those kind of ideals, and to live up to the ideals, for example, of the ideal fascist man in Italy, was not only to embody a virile martial figure, but also to be a father and to be a husband. So in Italy, for example, the bachelor tax that was introduced in 1926 punitively taxed men aged between 26 and 65 who, this is a quote from the law, do not perform their duty to the nation by marrying and procreating. And then from 1937, certain civil service roles and professions were reserved for married fathers. And as Lorenzo Benaduzzi, the historian, has shown, homosexual men were by definition understood to somehow represent, quote, enemies of this new man. And as that Italian bachelor tax indicates, many of these state interventions were punitive. And so to give just another couple of brief examples, if we look at the government subsidies for families in Spain, the plusdecargas familiares were paid direct to fathers, but with payments reduced or removed entirely if wives worked outside the home. And similarly, in Portugal, you can see how the Estado Novo changed maternity legislation to curtail the rights of working mothers. So these are kind of punitive ways in which non-desirable or non-anticipated relational roles are being kind of exercised. The dictatorial states all placed very great value on family relations and interpreted these as indicators of moral and political worth. So again, in fascist Italy, for example, the assessment process for prospective podestà, who were local fascist mayors installed in each locality, gave extra points in that process to men who were fathers. And then at the other end of the political spectrum, that same logic meant that police investigations of individuals who were suspected of committing political crimes of subversion were similarly evaluated, and they were evaluated more favourably, and lighter sentences were recommended for men who were married and who were fathers as compared to those who were not. Beyond that, all of the regimes exerted pressure on people through their familial roles to persuade them to adhere to regime policy. So, for example, making access to university dependent on a parent's membership of the party, or putting pressure on parents to enrol their children in regime youth groups, or coercing political detainees to sign declarations of guilt, including, for example, in Metaxas's Greece, the sort of very chilling documents that were known as declarations of repentance. And sort of putting, so political detainees were pressured to sign these on the promise of avoiding adverse repercussions for family members. So that kind of relational role is being instrumentalized by the regimes there. At the same time, for their own part, people who were living under the dictatorships recognised that their relationships with their friends, with their family, their intimate partners, their acquaintances and so on were very important resources that they could draw upon to mediate the intrusions of dictatorship to their advantage, whatever that kind of advantage might look like to them. So parents, for example, might intervene on behalf of their children, or wives on behalf of their husbands, in attempts to help their family members avoid censure or punishment by the regime, or even complicity. In Franquist Spain, for example, and in Greece under the colonels, we find lots of evidence in the police files and in oral history testimonies of cases in which parents interceded in investigations of their student offspring who'd been caught up in anti-regime protests. In Italy and in Spain, for example, we encountered cases in which a family member would actually deputise for another in their dealings with the state. So in Bologna, for example, a certain Laura Fagioli, who she wrote a memoir of her childhood, she described how her mother would stand in for what for her father, whom Laura called Lazy, but who was a fascist of the first hour, and so was a fully kind of paid-up member of the party. And her mother would stand in for him and deputise for him when he couldn't be bothered to go to the meetings of the local fascio. And she would then kind of report back the meeting's proceedings to him when she got back, only for her husband to berate her and hold her personally responsible for the idiotic discussions, as she called them, that had been had there. In Madrid, for example, conversely, really, during the period of student protests in December 1967, following the arrest of a student, a male student in this case, from the politics, business and economics faculty, who was accused of distributing placards and sort of trying to coordinate with students from other districts, the next day it was found that his sister had been arrested on the very same charges. And actually what had happened was, on learning of her brother's arrest, the sister had taken over her brother's duties as the Democratic Student Association faculty representative, so she was deputising for him, standing in. At other times, families themselves drew the state into their own conflicts and relationships, and so the instrumentalisation of denunciation practices to settle personal scores is something that is very well documented already across the dictatorial regime, so that's not something that we've looked into too much. But one area in which there's really quite a lot of ambivalence on the part of the dictatorship, certainly with respect to state intrusion in family relationships and how families would draw the state in, comes in with the issue of domestic violence and domestic abuse. So for some, states' intrusion in domestic disputes, even those that were engendering physical violence, was considered an unacceptable intrusion into private family relationships, even though, for example, in Italy anyway, domestic violence was theoretically a crime, and sometimes it was even punished as such. In other cases, we see individuals, women mostly, but not necessarily, or slightly more complicatedly in the case I'm about to tell you about, taking action themselves, which brought the state in, brought the state to bear in their domestic altercations. And here we might look at Vandana Joshi's work on Nazi Germany, and she found in relation to the ways in which women would draw the Gestapo into cases of domestic violence, that sort of by welcoming or even sort of initiating state intrusion and investigation of their husbands into crimes that they had to depict as being twins, so being both domestic abuse crimes and political crimes. By doing that, those women were effectively actively participating in bringing the state into their homes and into their domestic worlds. And so to just tell you a little miniature from the Italian case, to exemplify some of this kind of ambivalence of the family bringing the state into cases of sort of allied political slash domestic violence crime. This is a miniature that comes from the village of Amorosi in the south of Italy, or in Basilicata, a small village of under 3,000 inhabitants. And in this case, it was not only family members, so it was the wife and a son and a husband, but it was also neighbours and local Carabinieri officers who were caught up in an incident that was investigated by the Carabinieri and the prefecture as a political crime. And so what happened was, according to the police reports, after a day of drinking in a nearby village, a certain Bartolomeo Carbone, who was a farrier, returned to Amorosi, and when he got to the threshold of his home, and with several people around, including two Carabinieri officers in their nearby barracks, he proceeded to shout, quote, "down with fascism" and other anti-regime speech acts. And so the Carabinieri officers rushed to let their station commander know what had happened. And as they did, the village podesta, or sort of local mayor, arrived to say that, and again, this is a quote from the police report, he had just been warned that Carbone was being violent towards his family, and that was his wife Petruccia and his son Vincenzo. And when the Carabinieri arrived to arrest Carbone, they found that he had been, quote, forcibly dragged into the house by his wife and son, where he had then, quote, used violence towards them, smashing the glass of a display cabinet. You can read some of the reports here on the slide. So as he was led away by the Carabinieri, Carbone continued to insist that he was a gentleman and they were cowards. And interestingly, though, when she was later questioned, Petruccia, his wife, insisted that she had not heard her husband make these anti-regime statements. But her son Vincenzo, whose testimony is on the slide, insisted that he had heard these anti-regime statements. So he says, around 8 p.m. in this evening, my father came home drunk and began to lash out at me and my mother with his words and his fists. And in this violent struggle that he had, he smashed the glass of a display cabinet. Before entering the house, in the street, screaming like a madman, he had said, you didn't want to accept me into fascism, and I'm the first communist. Mussolini's followers are a load of cowards, down with fascism. So this was the testimony of the witness statement that he gave, which stood very much at odds with that of his mother. So the son's testament to his father's political statements, in addition to the violent behaviour, is perhaps all the more notable because the other bystanders who were present in the street when Carbone was supposed to have made these anti-regime statements, when they were interrogated, and this is a quote from the police report, feigned reticence, declaring that they had not understood or not heard because they fear Carbone. This was according to the arresting officers. And it emerged that neither Carbone's violence towards his family nor his anti-regime statements were a one-off, and on the contrary, they formed a pattern of behaviour that stretched back years. And Carbone was judged by the prefect to be, quote, addicted to drunkenness, which is kind of code word in the police reports for an alcoholic, and he had a series of prior convictions to his name. So it's important also, I think, it's interesting to note the attitudes of the regime authorities to this case, because I think they hint at sort of broader contemporary attitudes towards domestic abuse and towards the regime's role in relation to it. So in the recommendation that to the Interior Ministry that the Benevento prefect made, there was no mention of the domestic violence that has clearly been witnessed by the Carabinieri and testified to by Vincenzo Carbone. Rather, that report recommends that while the accused was evidently culpable of, quote, offending His Excellency the Head of Government, which was one of the laws, one of the crimes of subversion that could be punishable by several years of internal exile, potentially, the recommendation was that he should only be charged with the lesser offence of insulting a public official. And the reason for this, and this is a quote from the document, is that we should take into account his state of mental disequilibrium, significantly aggravated by drunkenness. And so the internal logic that might explain the prefect's ignoring of the evident domestic violence in this incident is suggested in the minutes of the testimony of the arresting officers who knew the family and who actually held Petruccia, Carbone's wife, jointly responsible for what they called their discordant relationship, and so by extension held her partially responsible for the violence that had been meted out to her and their son. So, just moving on then, it was not only the most intimate relationships that were intruded upon and instrumentalised politically, whether that's by the regime, by ordinary citizens, or both. Other relationships, though they might have been less intimate, were no less crucial to the navigation of life in the dictatorships. So, for example, the relationships between teachers and pupils, between neighbours, friends and colleagues, and within particular communities of experience. And so I just want to pause for a moment now on the social relations and bonds that connected teachers and pupils, which were very heavily lent upon by pupils and teachers themselves, as well as by the state and indeed by parents. And I think so the means through which schooling, the means through which the education system was used to sort of convey and instill regime ideology, so through the appropriation of school curricula and so on, and the kind of suffusing of school curricula with nationalist, imperialist, fascist values and content, that's very well known and very well explored by historians. But the ways in which the state sought to instrumentalise bonds between teachers, students and parents, I think has received less attention to this point, although it's certainly the case that the way in which teacher pressure was used as a sort of means for soliciting pupil and parental compliance with respect to enrolling in the national system of youth organisations. That's something that has been noted across all of the dictatorships that we look at already. But in general, of course, the relationship between teachers and pupils is a significant one, and for the pupils it's very often formative, and for many, the bonds that connected teachers and pupils comprise strong affection. So, for example, in a private school in Athens during the colonel's regime, the history teacher Cosmas, who was interviewed by my colleague Hugh, organised extracurricular cultural activities that were chosen by the students, so theatre trips, art exhibitions, literature study groups, trips to archaeological and heritage sites and so on. And he described doing this as part of a concerted effort on his part that students would experience something beyond the kind of state-prescribed curricula and the pedagogical priorities of the state. He said he wanted to, and this is a quote from the interview, allow the students to take part in different activities that were more liberal. In another example from Portugal, a teacher by the name of Leopoldino de Almeida intervened to defend his pupils who were being physically attacked by the police. This is quite an extreme example, really. Being physically attacked by the police as they went on a school trip to visit a soap and candle factory in the Alcântara district of Lisbon in 1947. And the teacher made a report subsequently to the school headmaster, which is how we know about the incident. And he recounted in that report how policemen had, quote, surrounded the boys waiting in front of the factory for the tour to begin and accused them of forming an illegal gathering, demanded to see their ID documents and then started beating them up. And the teacher's response was to go straight to the local police station and to complain stridently to the commander against the mistreatment of his pupils. Quite concerted standing up to authority and a standing up on the part of his pupil. So there's lots of these kind of examples of the ways in which the teacher-pupil relationship is one of affection, is one of support, and so on. However, for others, while the relationship between pupil and teacher might not have been marked by care or by affection, it was still very significant, very formative, and potentially quite complex. And this is another miniature from fascist Italy that sort of lays this out. And so this episode was recounted in a memoir of a young girl, an 8-year-old schoolgirl, Lina Catani, who lived in a village outside Bologna. It's held in the Archivio di Oristico Nazionale. So this miniature sets out a sort of complex chain of relationships that involves her mother, her father, school teacher, and sort of local unnamed regime representatives. And it's an incident that has an episode that has a really sort of lasting impact, not only on her, but also her parents' relationship with the dictatorship. And so I'll be able to read it. Yeah, that's the first part of it. So one day when she was at school in 1933, Catani and her fellow pupils were told by her teacher that the following Sunday they had to attend the nearby Casa del Fascio, which was several kilometres walk from her home, in order to provide a suitably large audience for a speech that was going to be delivered by an unspecified regime bigwig or high up. And in exchange, they were promised that each family would receive a focaccia loaf. And so, as you can read, she says, once I was home, I explained to my parents what I'd heard at school from my teacher. That first of all, I made them explain what a focaccia was, as I'd never heard this word. And they said, a pastry. So I'm guessing they didn't know either. I straight away started drooling. As for accompanying me, the reply was, no, we're not interested, we have to work. And this reply troubled me a bit, not knowing any more the reason for it. And then she says, during the week, the teacher repeated several times that it was important and that we should not miss it. But at home, the reply didn't change. My father said no, and no it was. In the end, I convinced my mother to accompany me. You see that kind of gendered kind of mediation at play there. So that's the first part of the story. So it continues. You don't necessarily need to read it all, but this is the whole story. So the playing on effective child-parent and teacher-pupil relationships to ensure attendance at the speech clearly pays off. So you can see from her account, Lena says, the hall was packed full between children and parents. But the more enduring result of this everyday encounter with the state was to seal the family's irreparable distance to the regime. And so once these regime high-ups had spoken and left, the local party boss, who was seated next to the teacher, stood up and said, after all, they were not going to distribute a focaccia loaf per family as they had promised. And he says, these loaves are not for you. We will offer them to the poor. And this was a room full of very impoverished families. And so for Catani, this was not only a sort of betrayal and disregard on the part of the regime representatives for the poverty of their families, of the families that were in the audience, who had walked kilometres on the promise of a focaccia loaf that they'd never seen before. And she says, we all asked ourselves, where are these poor, if they're not in this room? She also experienced it as a personal betrayal on the part of the teacher, whose primary bond had been revealed to be that with the regime, and evidently not the one that she shared with her pupils and their families. And so she says, my focaccia was definitely eaten by my teacher, who was sitting there very comfortable next to these suits, who thought themselves so intelligent to be able to explain the meaning of life to us. They, along with the teachers, were capable of deceiving so many innocent children. And so the enduring result, she says, of this interaction was the distancing of Lina and her parents from the political authorities, from the educational authorities. She says, for us, along with our parents, it was a great disrespect, remembered a lifetime. And it clearly confirmed her father's kind of pre-existing distrust that he already had. So moving on again. Time. Both friendships and neighbourly relations were significantly impacted by and mobilised in the dictatorships. And actually, I think friends and neighbourhoods were sort of really important vectors through which the relations between individuals and regimes were mediated. So friends and acquaintances could draw an individual into trouble with the regimes. There are countless police records detailing groups of friends getting into ill-advised, from the perspective of how they can be punished, political discussions or singing banned political songs, often fueled by alcohol, sometimes turning violent. And we see those throughout the police records that we've looked at. And without doubt, friendship was a key kind of vector or mediator through which the political violence of the regime was conducted and experienced. I mean, certainly at the beginning of the Italian fascist regime, you see countless stories of friends going off to engage in punishment expeditions. Or being targeted by them. Equally, one's friends and acquaintances could also be called upon at times of particular moments of encounter with the regime. So you could call in favours with friends, for example, that might help you to access a job or a university place or basic necessities like food and housing, particularly in times of shortage. But also with friends who had positions of trust within the regime, you might call in favours that might help you to evade dictatorial intrusions, including state surveillance and punishment. And we have lots of examples of that in the chapter. But if we return to Fitzpatrick and Ludke's framework of social bonds that I mentioned earlier, we can see that while some of the bonds of friendship were clearly strengthened through the experience of dictatorship in the case study countries we look at, other friendships were put under severe pressure and could even be broken by the sort of impositions of the regimes. In addition, new friendships could be forged through the lived experience of dictatorship, founded in perhaps new shared experiences that were engendered by the regime, so maybe through the regime youth groups and other organisations, but also through oppositional networks, or indeed through military service, or through participation in dictatorial and political violence. So I'm going to use a collage of miniatures that come from Greece now, which are most but not all taken from oral history interviews conducted by my colleague Hugh, that I think illustrate some of these kind of multiplicity and sort of complex kind of invokings of the bonds of friendship. So certainly many friendships were strained by the advent of the colonel's regime in Greece. So in Athens, for example, in an interview, the left-wing actress Erasmia told us how she gradually broke off contact with a right-wing royalist friend of hers after an incident at the latter's house party that made her feel unsafe. Whilst Barbastelios, who was a man then in his late 30s and was a right-winger, but he was very much opposed to the colonel's regime, he reported in an interview that, quote, he even broke off saying good morning to one of his childhood friends who was pro-regime, and that was really important to him. And he described in the interview how for the very first time in his life he began to form new friendships with left-wingers through their sort of shared mistrust and opposition to the to the colonel's regime. These sources also demonstrate some of the sort of dissertoian tactics that Greeks employed to preserve friendships that came under pressure through dictatorial rule. So, for example, in a report published in the British newspaper The Guardian in 1969, a journalist and writer named Geoffrey Moorhouse wrote of how he spent the nights in a taverna in a Peloponnesian village where, and this is a quote, he was escorted home by several slightly tipsy youths singing the band songs of Theodorakis by a circuitous route, they explained, so they wouldn't have to pass the police station and embarrass a sergeant who was a friend of theirs. And in an oral history interview, again, a right-winger or someone who had been a right-winger during the colonel's dictatorship named Makis, who was a policeman under the colonel's regime, he painted a sort of similar picture, but sort of from the flip side, from the other side of the coin. And Makis had a friend who was centre-right politically, but who was opposed to the colonel's regime and who owned a shoe repair shop. And in this shop, people would gather to discuss politics, usually very critical of the regime, and they would do that openly, even when Makis, the policeman, who they knew and who was a friend of theirs, was present. But in Makis's words in the interview, he said, "They took care not to cross a line that would expose me, that would place me in a difficult position." So friendships being invoked in different ways to kind of navigate in a sort of complex route through the experience of the regime. But the dictatorships could also make the formation of new bonds more difficult. So as we discussed in another chapter of their book, the result of this is very often a sort of contraction in the size of people's social circles, and at least certainly a reduction in the number of intimate bonds and in which politics could felt, in which people felt they could discuss politics openly, as well as we saw for some people a sort of preference for socialising in more private spaces away from kind of potential ears and surveillance. At the same time, however, oral testimonies very often sort of evoke the bonds that were preserved or were created or strengthened by the under the colonel's regime, and they depict these as being even stronger, being even more sort of emotionally charged and significant precisely because of the repressive and cautious climate. And so, as the left-winger Fanis put it in one of the interviews we conducted, he said, "Emotions were just more intense. The need to see your friends was more intense. Of course, we were young then, and that's always the case with young people. But also the emotion, that hiding, that illegality, that fear that they might see us, always looking out for who was following you, all of that element of strain, we lived it. And so the wine that you drank with your friends in the taverna as you shot the breeze was much warmer." So, as a way of sort of moving towards a conclusion, I just want to reflect for a couple of minutes on a set of miniatures that I suppose acts as a sort of inverse or flip side to the instrumentalization of social bonds and affective relationships. And that is when we asked in our chapter on being alone in the dictatorship, what happens to the lived experience of dictatorship when social bonds may be lacking, or when they are disrupted, or when they are absent? And so in this chapter of that we're calling Being Alone in the Dictatorship, here we go. We look at various kinds of isolation, which might be geographic, might be spatial, might be physical, but also social. And we look at that from the perspective of some forms of isolation that were implemented, intentionally cultivated by the regimes against perceived opponents, but also other forms of being alone, or what we might call solitude, that were desired by individuals and instigated by individuals, and which could be instrumentalized differently and perhaps to create distance from the regime, and sometimes indeed run sort of counter to dictatorial authority. And so here, for that particular chapter, our starting point is kind of twofold. So on the one hand, we were thinking about Carlo Levi and his very sort of notable, famous experience of the political punishment of confino, or internal exile, which he described in his book Christ Stopped at Eboli, that was published in 1947. And in that book, he sort of described a sort of profound sense of loneliness and isolation and abandonment during his internal exile in the remote towns of Grassano and Aliano, which in the book he calls Galliano, but are both in Basilicata in the far south of Italy. But we were also wanting to kind of come back to Hannah Arendt, who I talked about earlier, and her evaluation of the atomization of society in a totalitarian regime, that kind of idea that had prompted Alf Lüdke and Fitzpatrick's study of social bonds. So Arendt distinguished between rule that she said is based on isolation, which she said was when a regime succeeds in sort of disintegrating the political ties between people in the public sphere, and rule based on loneliness, which she said is achieved only when a regime is able to go further and really disrupt or dismantle the bonds that bind people together in their private lives and private spaces. And so the latter, she said, was rule over lonely, not only isolated men. And for her, that was really the hallmark of totalitarianism. And Fitzpatrick and Ludker, in that chapter that I just mentioned, they broadly concur with this in the sense that whilst they clearly critiqued Arendt's pessimism, and they emphasised how some old, as I said earlier, some old bonds could endure and some new bonds could emerge under totalitarian rule. But they also kind of agreed with her in the sense that they affirmed that individuals who were excluded from Soviet society and Nazi society, quote, found themselves literally switched off. So loneliness then was more than just sort of physical isolation, having to do with the nature of the bonds that exist between people. And so for the most part, if coming back to Carlo Levi, his isolation was of course mostly geographical. It was kind of a literal spatial confinement in remote villages in the south of Italy. But actually, to his surprise, as he recounts in his memoir, the loneliness that he experienced most acutely came during a brief visit home upon the death of a close relative. So Carlo Levi had been anticipating this kind of emotional reunion with old friends, familiar places, but instead he said he felt isolated, far away, and unable to adapt myself to the places and persons I had longed to see. Many of my acquaintances avoided me for the sake of their own safety. Others I myself kept away from in order not to compromise them. And so prisoners, and not just political prisoners, and not just historically in these dictatorships, of course, very commonly experience social alienation on their release. But Levi's sense of isolation here at home is clearly bound up with the kind of the corrosive, the coercive, the intrusive nature of dictatorial rule and the ways in which social intimacy could become actually a danger or a liability rather than a sort of haven from dictatorship. So we find that all of the dictatorships that we examine were adept at creating forms and structures of isolation for those that they deemed to be subversive or undesirable or alien to the idealized, imagined communities that they said they wanted to construct. And all of the regimes intentionally cultivated loneliness for perceived opponents, whether directly through means like such as exile, imprisonment, or solitary confinement, or more indirectly by creating the conditions for social, cultural, and political isolation of so-called undesirable individuals or communities. So, for example, in the Portuguese fortress prison of Peniche on the Atlantic coast, where many of the political prisoners of the Salazar's regime were held, family visits were reduced to an absolute minimum. Communication amongst the prisoners were also curtailed through arbitrary punishments and a culture of fear. And as one anonymous account of a former prisoner put it, he said, "The prisoners are not allowed to help each other. Many have been punished for giving an orange or an apple to a comrade." And another former prisoner in Peniche reported the sort of impossible paradox that they found themselves living under, that, and this is a quote, "One cannot speak loudly because it is forbidden to make noise, and one cannot speak quietly because the guards have to be able to hear the conversations." But at other times, and at the same time, other prisoners, exiles and so on, found themselves able to deploy various tactics as a way of kind of mitigating or trying to mitigate these lonely conditions. And here we come back to sort of the idea of people trying to forge social bonds in very difficult circumstances. So there are examples recorded in the testimonies of women and men who were held as political prisoners in Spain and during the Greek rule of the colonels, who write or talk about various kinds of coded communication, the kind of transmitting of coded messages between cells, noise making, banging of pots or banging on prison bars, singing, and even sort of writing on the condensation of cell windows, all those kind of efforts to kind of mitigate that sense of isolation and sort of reforge bonds. And back in Peniche, the prisoners coordinated regular hunger strikes and shouted there in unison to raise awareness of their circumstances among the local civilian population. And according to an independent report on the prison population, and this is a quote, "Their refusal to eat and the shouting in chorus against the arbitrariness, etc., are marked by a great unanimous spirit of sacrifice, despite all the efforts made by the wardens to divide and to isolate." So just to illustrate all of this with a sort of very, very final miniature, this relates again to the case of Italy. and the experience of a certain Gino Avancini, who was an Italian anti-fascist who was who served 2 years of internal exile on the Tyrrhenian island of Ponza after his arrest in April 1937. And he wrote an account of that time, and that's also held in the Archivio di Aristico Nazionale in Tuscany. So on Ponza, Avancini found what he called, quote, a community of confinati, which initially at least struck him as, and this is another quote, an ideal society functioning according to the criteria of self-management and on the basis of rigorously egalitarian principles. And so he described how, so for example, daily tasks were shared fairly and without exception. The cooking was excellent, he said, with fish, goat, rabbits and vegetables almost always on the menu. And for many, that was a significant improvement in terms of variety of foods and calorie content than the food that had been available at home. The confinati who had trades took up those trades in confinement, so providing haircuts and tailoring and shoe mending, carpentry, but also educational courses of study in anti-fascist activity, even in this context of confino. And so Avancini put it, he said, the sojourn on the island would have been in several respects almost pleasant. So obviously there are caveats and there are limits to the way in which this could be seen, even by Avancini, as an enjoyable and egalitarian environment in which sort of newly formed bonds and relations of common imprisonment and exile are being forged. And precisely what prevented Avancini from seeing his confinement on Ponza as being pleasant, as he put it, was what he called the moral malaise of exile and the recurrent thoughts of one's family. And so, of course, it was a case that many families of confinati were left very financially vulnerable by the loss of wages of their main breadwinner, and also very much socially isolated, often in their communities. Moreover, after several months on Ponza, Avancini's kind of enthusiasm waned as he began to see all the cracks in the facade of community solidarity and relations. And so he observed, and this is a quote, the relationship between confinati was more complex and less idyllic than they had first appeared to be, to me, on my arrival on the island. And he said, although they were held together by the connective tissue of common anti-fascism, the sort of disparate socioeconomic class and educational and regional and factional distinctions between them that sort of differentiated the exiles made this community fracture into smaller groupings, which sometimes could come into conflict with each other. And also he recognised that the kind of continual departure and arrival of new and old confinati hindered effectively the development of a really stable and enduring sense of cohesion amongst them. And what's more, for Avancini, his sense of isolation, we have to recognise his isolation from his political comrades, from his friends, but even from his family, had begun long before he ever set foot on Ponza. So he recorded in his memoir that already in 1923 he had been dismissed from his job on the railways in Florence, and he said that that signalled his marking, quote, both in the police headquarters and fascist offices as a subversive. And from there began what he called bitter days for him and his family, as his friends started to distance themselves one by one, as did their relatives. And he said fear was in the air, and so they tried not to expose themselves. Then the dismantling of political parties after 1925 constituted a sort of further sort of tightening and restricting of his political social circle, as enforced clandestinity, which sort of necessarily entailed the abandonment of, or near abandonment, let's say, of often sort of very convivial political meetings, and instead they had to meet only in very small cells of no more than four or five individuals, only one of whom could be in touch with people higher up the command chain. And then also as political comrades increasingly one by one disappeared, either to exile or to imprisonment or to illegality in order to try and make ends meet. So his social world was getting very, very small long before he was sent into confino. But as the repression continued, he recalled that this kind of imperative to what he said, what he described as to not lose contact with comrades, became all-consuming. And simultaneously, very sadly, he found his sense of isolation at home increased as his sort of undiminished, his sort of continued commitment to political resistance clashed with his wife's sense of pragmatism and her sort of concern of what the repercussions on the family would be. And he said in his memoir, sometimes we didn't speak to one another for days and days. So it's a very kind of changing story of an interplay of isolation and solitude and social bonds and those kind of imperatives and sort of impulses kind of often clashing. There's a lot more I could say, but I need to finish. So I'm just going to end on a couple of slightly disjointed observations. So the first observation to make is that there is a paradox at the centre of the dictatorship's leveraging of social bonds and effective relationships, particularly when it comes to the family, but not only. So on the one hand, the regime certainly understood that these kind of intimate human relations, interactions between couples, between parents and children, between wider family members, between friends, all of these the regime saw to different extents as falling within the purview of the dictatorial state and saw them as sort of potential conduits or vectors for the realization of their projects to sort of fundamentally transform society and individuals. At the same time, though, in doing that, the dictatorships necessarily found themselves in the position of having to somehow mobilize relations, which actually they didn't and perhaps could never entirely dictate. So it's kind of a key source of the utility of these very intimate bonds and these intimate relationships lies in its very ambiguity. So it's both the fact that they can be mobilized to different ends that this makes them so useful, but also makes them ultimately uncontrollable. It's the fact that these intimate sort of human relations kind of move between and combine sort of more private-facing, inward-facing functions alongside public outward-facing roles that makes them so both so attractive but also so ultimately unmobilizable. It's not really a word, never mind. Second observation is to reflect that whilst it's really clear to us that pre-existing social bonds, pre-existing relationships, whether that's family relationships, friendship relationships, or wider still, all of these are invoked and instrumentalized and sometimes ruptured both by the regime and by the people who lived under their rule. But what resulted from this invoking or this instrumentalization is not uniform and it's not assured and it's not very, again, not very easily predictable. So on the contrary, the outcome of this kind of mobilising and manoeuvring relationships and bonds, whether that's in the service of individuals or in the service of the state, was very complicated, it was often ambivalent, and it was unpredictable. So certainly this kind of leveraging of social bonds took place asymmetrically. So these bonds are being leveraged by people who have different positionality in relation to the structures and the sources of power in the dictatorship, and that definitely plays a role in determining the outcome of that leveraging of bonds and social relations, but it is also the case that people did succeed in using their family and other sort of relational bonds to act tactically or to find a sort of way of manoeuvring through dictatorship, even from relatively disempowered positions. And then very finally, I think I want to acknowledge some of the limitations of what I've discussed, and I'm very, very aware that there are groups of people and types of relations that haven't been discussed, which is partly due to the source base and partly due to time, of course. I haven't talked very much about gender, but I hope you can see how it's very much part of this story. But I also very clearly have discussed only heterosexual relationships today, and there is a little bit of our chapter that discusses how the regimes intervened in gay men and women's, particularly men's, relationships. But we have far fewer sources kind of give us a sort of own voice perspective of those men and women than we would like. And of course, there's lots of excellent work that's been done in that field now. But I think it's important to acknowledge the limitations of what I'm talking about and to recognise that there are many gaps. But I think I'm completely out of time. So I'm happy to pick up on that in the discussion now, if wanted. But I'll leave it there. And that's just to acknowledge our funding source once again. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. You gave us so much food for
thought.
So
let's open the debate. Any questions? First round
of questions. Okay. I have one. Okay, you go first. Well, first of all, thank you very much for your presentation. It was extraordinary. I'm really interested on this approach in everyday life, because in a short-lived dictatorship, such as the one I'm studying, which is the Primo de Rivera dictatorship in Spain from 1923 to 1930, everything boils down to analyzing when it fell down, how it fell, and even viewing the dictatorship, just just as a parenthesis. Especially for me, as I'm studying kind of civic militia, it's kind of a civic militia.
Yeah.
I found myself faced with several things that you have mentioned.
Mm.
Even though you focus on the ones that are repressed by the dictatorship, and I focus on the ones who carry on different types of dictators of repression. There are the clear link between the dictatorship and the people, about the citizens and everything. You know? The military power, for example, and also they see themselves, and the dictatorship also embraces the idea that the Somaten is some kind of moral school and moral police, even though. So we can link this with the morality and all the things on the dictatorship promotes. So I will ask you about the other part, no, of the everyday life of the ones who carry on, the ones who carry the repression. Have you or your team in this project have found any differences on the basis, on the points to check on the ones that are carrying the repression?
Thank you. It's a really important question. And so I think one of the things that I think the approach like this does is maybe disrupts a little bit that binary of on the one hand, those who are repressed and those who are perpetrating the oppression, because obviously, I mean, no doubt in the Somaten, in the Primavera Vera dictatorship too, there are people move between some of those positions a little bit.
Yeah, because it's not like a real police.
Yeah.
They are like, they are normal people, citizens. So yeah, it's like this is a very strange lane because you can count that as just repressive people, but obviously it's like the normal people, and it's very...
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, so sometimes those very people who are, in some respects, carrying out or effectively exercising dictatorial violence and authority sometimes find themselves on the receiving end of it. And so, as a short answer, we definitely look at at the experiences of those who, in some way, occupy positions of, have that positionality that is perhaps a bit closer to the regimes and so on. So, just to stick with the theme of social bonds and relationships, we certainly find that the exercising of political violence very much draws on these kind of invoking of friendship bonds and so on. So, it's very much the case friends draw other friends into violence. To take the case I know best, which is obviously Italy, the punishment expeditions that people would engage in the early 1920s, up until the point that militia is institutionalised, really quite early in fascist rule. But those punishment expeditions or that kind of political violence continues in many ways to surface, and it very often emerges through friendship networks or family. So very often brothers being involved, brothers drawing brothers into violence. Or friends drawing friends into violence, and drawing on those kind of links as a way of either pulling people into the regime, and then conversely, of course, for those who find themselves on the receiving end of violence, then that often draws family and friends into the violence. But other than that, then I think it's often against the case, just coming it back to the kind of trying to sort of push against that binary of the repressed and the perpetrators, because there are countless cases, again, using the Italian example, of people who are fascist party members or who are fascist militia members, who still find themselves in trouble for somehow contravening a banned political song, or for saying something against the regime that they were. So in those kind of everyday settings, particularly in settings like bars where alcohol might be involved, you see people moving between those positions and finding themselves suddenly kind of flipped from being a sort of regime representative and to being a sort of someone on the receiving end. So I think recognizing the mobility of people to move between those positions is really useful. But yeah, of course, fascists have their everyday life too, and yeah, it's worth knowing about it.
Any other questions? Okay, I have several. I don't want to
the sea, no, perhaps I would ask you. So the first one, about sources.
Mm.
You mentioned ego documents, of course, oral history, published media, which are pretty, it's crystal clear the reason why you choose this kind of documents. But you talk about also police report, of course, and governmental documents.
Yeah.
This sounds interesting. I mean, you're looking at from bottom-up approach. But what kind of, the question is, what kind of governmental documents do you analyze? So this is the first question. The second question, related to the comparative analysis, no? I mean, this huge project, which sounds amazing, actually, you analyze several countries, not least Zimbabwe, which will deserve, like, another seminar, actually.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting.
It sounds so interesting. But the question is, where this interference of the dictatorship in this family and friends bonds were more effective.
Mm.
I mean, did you discover some kind of, a bigger impact of this interference in this kind of private bonds in one of the countries or more than one of the countries? It was pretty interesting, the text that the primary source that you have mentioned about the denunciation of the son and the wife, towards the father, and it was super interesting the fact that he was not depicted as an alcoholic, which is pretty common. I mean, when I was I analyzed the Special Tribunal for the Defense of the State in Libya, and most of the people that was declared guilty of several crimes, most of them, I mean, not by chance, I think they were alcoholics. We know that the regime condemned alcoholism as one of the evil of the for the nation. So there was also the regime also took several measures to fight alcoholism. So the question was, my question is, in your experience, in your field of analysis, was this kind of was a partner? I mean, the presence of the connection between alcoholism and in order to, for instance, intervene in cases of domestic violence. I mean, it was a partner, this use of this, how can I say, parallelism with the, between alcoholism, anti-fascism, to interfere in the private life of the people.
Yeah.
Very last question. You mentioned the fact that you did not go deeper into non-marginalized groups.
Yeah.
And my question is: was it a problem of lack of primary sources or just a lack of time? Thank you so much. Sorry.
No,
thank
you.
I have more. I'll stop here.
Thank you. On the sources. I guess it's definitely not only an issue with everyday life history that we don't always have the sources that we wish we would have. I mean, I guess we all love it when we find those kind of own voice sources, the ego documents, the letters, the diaries, the memoirs. And obviously, if you can do oral history, then you have that option too. It brings its own complications, but I think it's an incredibly rich source. So, yeah, we can't always be working with those sources, so we have inevitably to work with sources that have been produced in some way by the regimes that we're investigating. People working on colonial history, of course, deal with that kind of sort of fundamentally biased archive all the time, and anybody who's working to restore sort of the perspectives of people who don't tend to be overrepresented in archives have that. So, in that sense, the police records are incredibly rich. I at first, when I was doing my PhD, I refused to use those kind of sources because I was being all kind of, I can do this or that. But I was wanting to ask, well, how present is the dictatorship in people's lives? And I wanted to look at how it moves in and out. So then only looking at official sources, which clearly document the moments in, if they do document ordinary inverted commas people, only document their moments of encounter with the state. And I was wanting to ask something about, like, you know, how much did they encounter the state? But for this, or more recently, I've just got over that kind of that block, and find them incredibly rich sources. So with the governmental records, for example, I mean, even obviously in legislation and in sort of local party reports, I find incredibly useful. I mean, I have, of course, looked at informants' reports, but I find that they're tricky. Of course, they're one person's perspective. I mean, all of those, I mean, of course, they tell us a really important part of this story is to know what the regimes are trying to do anyway. In order to kind of understand sort of bottom-up constructions, you have to also understand and think about from-above constructions and recognise that they're happening in concert with each other. So, of course, you can get that from those kind of governmental records. You can get the intentions of the regime. But they do also very often somehow indirectly also give rise to... it gives us a sense of kind of what's happening on the ground. So, I mean, police reports have witness statements. Obviously, that's filtered, and obviously that's written down by the officers producing the report. But even governmental records that, for example, they often complain about things that are not happening that should be happening, and so then that gives you a sense of, you know, of kind of the gap that might exist between the intentions or the desired outcomes of the regime and what's actually happening. So I think, yeah, the complaints of official government records are really useful, and then also the filtered kind of voices, the indirect access you get to from below perspectives, but that is very filtered, and so that's what I think you have to read. So you might read those government documents, or we read the government documents along the grain for the intentions of the regime, but also against the grain to try and get the gaps, to get the complaints and the filtered kind of voices. So yeah, that's what we've been doing. On the comparative frame, yeah, and I mean it's funny. I'm so resistant to saying, well, it was more like this in Italy, and it was less like this in Greece, because I just don't think it's not easy to say it just like that. And yet, I've just expanded this comparative frame, and it has been incredibly interesting to work with people with expertise on Argentina and Zimbabwe and on Southern Africa and on South Africa in apartheid as well. And it's remarkable how many kind of points of comparison or points of similarity in terms of the ways in which these different colonial, post-colonial, and authoritarian regimes are kind of trying to kind of infiltrate people's kind of lived experience and the different kinds of tactics and sort of responses that people give. That's not to say that I think there's some kind of universal way in which people respond to authoritarianism. But then again, I see sort of similarities with the present day in the way in which people are responding to some elements of authoritarianism. So there are definitely kind of points of contact. So I think obviously there are, and we do need to kind of have a better answer for this in the book, I think, as we come to finish it. I think we can say it. So, for example, in Greece under the colonels, of course, it's a much shorter time span. And I think that's plays a big role in terms of determining lived experience. But I wouldn't necessarily, and arguably the colonels were not trying to create fundamentally new men and women in the way that you might say that some of the other regimes were. I mean, obviously in Salazar's Portugal, notably scholars talk about that there isn't that kind of equivalent of a new man. The kind of the Portuguese idealized man that Salazar kind of paints is very much a sort of every man, a very sort of kind of hardworking, respectable rural worker, and that's very different, say, to that kind of fascist Italian idealization of kind of fundamentally remaking men and women, although how far people actually experienced that and then actually became these new men and women is debatable. So there is definitely a kind of we can trace different extents to which the regimes were trying to fundamentally remodel different aspects of society, and we can certainly trace a difference in terms of of time frame and kind of variation over time, but at the same time that doesn't map on in any way to violence necessarily. And like, so they obviously the experience of Greeks who did oppose the colonel's regime was one of very significant, was of torture, of imprisonment, of exile, of murder, and so on. And so there isn't a kind of a correlation. So I certainly wouldn't be suggesting that one is worse to live through than the other. I mean, I just don't think you could go through. That's not somewhere I think would be very sensible of me or productive in any way to go. So on that domestic abuse miniature and the role of alcohol, I mean, that's something that I have been really interested in. I think it's really interesting and important because, yeah, as you say, the regimes have different attitudes towards alcohol. But I think one of the most interesting ways in which it feeds up from a kind of a bottom-up perspective of how you experience your encounters with the state, particularly if we look at police reports, whether in Italy or in Franco Spain, for example, we see that alcohol. First of all, we see that alcohol is obviously often present when people are accused of having kind of contravened, or having spoke out against the regime, or having sung something, or having done something that in some ways is interpreted as being politically subversive. But when the sort of local representatives of the regime are kind of trying to understand and apportion sort of degrees of blame for that, alcohol feeds right into those assessments and alcoholism. So in the kind of in the police reports in for example in Italy and Spain, we see that when the local officers are producing their reports and recommending or suggesting whether or not something should go to trial, they make statements that assess the political and moral worth of an individual that are completely conflated. So they'll say so-and-so is not a member of any political, or is not known to have been a member of any political parties when that was possible, but they are an alcoholic. So membership, sort of prior kind of being known already to the authorities for having had some political, organised political affiliation in the past, that's going to get you, I mean, you're going to be in much more trouble. So is being an alcoholic. So being judged to be an alcoholic, that's certainly going to, you know, because so that kind of eliding of moral and political worth. And then similarly, whether or not you have a job, fact is part of very often in that assessment. So if you have a job, if you have a family, if you have dependents, then you're judged much more favourably. So it's definitely feeding into those assessments, and they're very conflated of like conflating in terms of your political value, your political reliability, and your kind of moral reliability that is evidenced by having a job, having a family, and or being an alcoholic. And then one of the things that I found really interesting when I've looked at this in the past is how being perceived to be an alcoholic or having drunk alcohol when you said something or when you committed a so-called political crime, how that plays out in the law. Because so in the case of Italy, which is the one that I have done research into this for, in theory up until 1930, having drunk alcohol at the time of committing any crime was supposed to be a mitigating thing. So in the Zanardelli Code, it's a mitigation. There are various kind of gradations of being voluntarily drunk or involuntarily drunk and all of that. But then in the Rocco Code in 1930, that's completely reversed. And so having drunk alcohol at the time of committing a so-called crime should be an aggravating factor. You should get into more trouble. But in the police reports, that isn't reflected. So the police reports continue to say, oh, well, they drunk alcohol. I mean, they so often say, well, they kind of accept the line that if you'd been drinking alcohol when you said something that was anti-regime, then you didn't mean to do it. Or, people often say, I don't remember having done this because I had drunk alcohol. And that is accepted so often, even after that change in law. It's really, and what's more important is, if you're judged to be an alcoholic, then it's not. So that only works for you if if you're considered politically reliable and you have a family and so on, and you say, I'm sorry, I had drunk alcohol, I didn't mean it, then it kind of will work for you, or it's more likely to work for you. And other non-marginalised groups, what was I going to say? Yeah. Oh, no, the marginalised groups. Um, So it is definitely something that is a bit more present in the, or is going to be more present in the book than it was in our talk. I think it's partly because of the story of complexity, because we're trying to recognize all of these different aspects of one's positionality in relationship to power play into one's experience. So, of course, if you're in a marginalized group, whether that's on the basis of religion or race, ethnicity or sexuality, then your experience is quite different to that of a kind of heteronormative. And obviously women's, to some extent, women's experiences differ to men. So it's something that we need to integrate a bit more. But yeah, I recognise that I hadn't done it so much in this talk. I can't think of what else I need to say on that, but does that answer enough?
Thank you so much. Any other questions?
Yeah, I have one. You talk about the modern fallen soldiers were important to society. They were not in the life, but their own son was sacrificed to the idea of the just cause of the state.
Mm.
What happened with the mothers who opposed this idea of sacrificing their own children for the state? Were they considered like crazy? Were they just ignored? Or were not that many in those dictatorships?
Yeah, because of course, I mean, that is, and also the mothers of people who had died in opposition to dictatorship. Of course, in the regime's eyes, they have absolutely no status or no positive status whatsoever. I think it's really interesting. So again, I have to go back to the Italian case for me, because that's the one that I know, and I do recognise that when I'm talking about this project and I'm not with the other people who conducted the research, I always end up turning a bit more to the Italian case, because it's the one that I personally sort of contributed to the project. But there, you certainly get some public pronouncements of course, and private pronouncements of women who see the sacrifice of their children or their sons as a waste and as a waste of precious life, and have no and of course they're not the women that are being brought to the into these kind of exalted positions. So it's particularly in Italy, certainly it's particularly the women who are the mothers of either soldiers who fought in the Ethiopian campaign, and you do see some mothers of Italians who fell in the Spanish Civil War as well, who are given that same kind of elevated position, even though of course it's not openly acknowledged they're presented as being volunteers rather than as kind of representatives of the Italian state in any way, but also particularly mothers of those who were who are killed in the course of the violence and the takeover of power, that are given that particular pedestal. So there are kinds, I guess, there are sort of gradations, both in the sense of which mothers of which soldiers that are elevated more than others. And then on the other side, there are, of course, women who push back and say, you know, I don't want my son's sacrifice or death to be invoked in the service of this service of the regime, but to do that publicly is quite a difficult thing. So we see it quite often in the diaries, of course, that we look at, and then in the memoirs. But of course, they're written after the event, and so there's a lot of kind of, obviously they're written in the knowledge of what happened, from the point of experience to the point of writing. But yeah, thank you. It's an important question.
Because so many of what you say, I believe that it could be applied in some democratic countries, as we consider it.
Yeah.
But in some states of emergency, like in the First World War, like so many of the cases, like the idealization of masculinity, the glorification of non-fallen soldiers. And I would ask your opinion about this.
Yeah.
You believe that a lot of these ways could be applied in those emergency states, or it's like a different context. Yeah. But your opinion.
I mean, context is always important. So, and context is always relevant in some way, I think, to shaping the nature of an experience or the particular ways in way in which it plays out in that time. And of course, you can't really, when you're dealing with these kind of individual episodes, you can't take them out of their experience because they happen in and where, you know, when they do. So, but I absolutely agree that many of the kinds of ways of relating and modes of behaviour to kind of ways of relating to authority are ones that can exist in democratic conflicts and I guess the contexts. And I think, of course, we have to recognise that, again, a binary between dictatorship on the one hand and democracy on the other is also something that we need to blur quite often. I mean, plenty of past and present democratic contexts are ones in which forms of sort of more authoritarian or less authoritarian kind of action are enacted. And actually, so in the in that article that we just published on Wednesday, that is co-written with the with Nat Andrews, who works on Argentina, and Usha Kufakunari, who works on Zimbabwe. There, we're very much interested in kind of disrupting that kind of binary, like distinction between democracy and dictatorial context as being sort of fundamental. You know, that you can only, this is how you behave in a democracy, and this is how you behave in a dictatorship. Because both of the case studies that that Nat and Usha write on and are producing their own articles for, actually, as part of this project. Contexts which kind of move between so-called democratic and so-called or different forms of them. So I suppose Usha is writing about a Zimbabwean context in which moves from colonial to post-colonial but authoritarian and to the present day, which is obviously very is still very complex in terms of how you might define it. And in Argentina, Nat has chosen specifically to look at the period of the 1930s, which is not necessarily kind of not officially periods of time that are not officially dictatorial, but in which you see kind of the presence of effectively more authoritarian types of rule, precisely to try and kind of disrupt that sort of binary. And there's a scholar that we use, and I can't remember their name now. It will come to me, or I'll think about it and let you know. Who specifically makes that kind of argument that that we see, you know, in democratic contexts, we see impulses that are clearly more dictatorial. And I guess we can think about living in 2025, I guess we can all think of contexts in which we might see that happening too. So I think it's a really important point, so thank you for making it.
Thank you. It was a real great pleasure and honor for us to have you here, and see you next month for the next seminar. Thank you.
Thank you.